From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Did American astronauts actually land on the moon? Do you still have questions about Obama's birth certificate?
It's one of the greatest scams in the history of politics and in the history, period.
A class at Emory studies conspiracy theories. It's a lesson from left field. First, though, last week, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer made something up. He said Hitler did not use chemical weapons, which is quite patently untrue. Spicer apologized, but he did not resign.
Yeah, he should be fired. I mean, the worst thing is that he's normalizing Hitler.
That's Break Room regular Hector Fernandez. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Jennifer Schmidt from Gillsville, Georgia. The thing is, he is normalizing Trump, and anyone who resembles Trump is therefore going to be normalized. That's how we brainwash.
We always love to get your thoughts. You can call us like Jennifer did and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter and we're on it all the time. It's at OST Talk. Or find us on Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. More than 100 Atlanta teachers have joined a federal age discrimination lawsuit. That suit claims teachers were forced out of their jobs by an administration that was openly hostile to employees over the age of 40. Cheryl Patterson worked for 23 years in the Atlanta Public School District. She was laid off in 2013. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Also with us is Charlotte Alexander. She's an assistant professor specializing in employment law at Georgia State University. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, good morning.
Cheryl, tell me a little bit about what happened with you. You had worked in APS as a teacher of several grades?
Yes, I started with fourth grade. And at one point, Atlanta Public Schools moved the fourth to eighth grade teachers to the middle school.
Okay.
And a lot of teachers retired rather than jump from teaching second grade or to go
right.
to seventh grade.
It's a very different task.
Yes, so a lot of teachers retired. But I taught middle school in Los Angeles, so it was just like throwing me back to where I came from. And when I first got there, I was in a meeting with the principal for the first month that I was there. And he asked me, how many years did I have before I could retire? And that shocked me because I hadn't been thinking about retiring. So
pause.
Okay.
Charlotte, is that legal? Can I ask an employee how long do you have before you can retire?
Yeah, well, there's nothing in federal age discrimination law that bans that particular question. So, yes, the question in and of itself is not problematic, but we'll see. Combined with other things, it may prove to be problematic.
Right. And that was combined with other things,
that
Cheryl.
That was combined with
because,
a lot of different things.
Right. Your classes were doing well on their tests and on with their grades, right?
Yes.
Okay. But they laid you off.
Yes. They non-renewed me and attempted to discredit my character because what they put in writing, it would be hard for me as a principal to hire me. So my problem with that was defamation of character more so. You know,
you were less worried about the fact that they laid you off than about the fact that they justified it with negative comments that make
yes.
it difficult for you to find another job.
Yes.
How common is that, Charlotte, in these kind of cases?
Well, so there are a few different issues here. So there's the underlying question about age discrimination and then how an employer defends against the complaint that they discriminated on the basis of age. And so an employer will try to substantiate whatever action they took against an employee by saying it wasn't discrimination, it was this other thing that was actually problematic. So it is common for there to be a dispute when an employee is dismissed or treated negatively at work. It's common to have a dispute about why. Was it discrimination or was it something else? Where the employer is saying it's this non-discriminatory reason.
Then let's go back to what exactly we are protected from. What is in the law that, and in this case, we're not talking about senior citizens. That certainly doesn't include Cheryl. We're talking about anybody over the age of 40. So what does the law say?
Right. So the Federal Age Discrimination in Employment Act, or the ADEA, protects workers or employees who are age 40 and above. Different states have their own versions of age discrimination laws. So Georgia has a law that just protects workers 40 to 70. But the federal law protects 40 and above, and it protects employees from any sort of negative consequence on the job that results from discrimination against them due to their age. Mm-hmm. So it can be lack of promotion or lack of access to promotion. It can be termination. It can be harassment. Anything negative that can be traced back to a discriminatory intent on the part of the employer.
Cheryl, I want to read you the statement we got from the Atlanta Public School District and get your response. They say, quote, a lawsuit has been filed against Atlanta Public Schools by a group of former employees alleging APS discriminated against them and other teachers over the age of 40. APS vehemently denies these allegations and intends to vigorously defend against these claims. The case is still in its early stages. APS looks forward to proving no such discrimination took place, end quote. One of the defenses is that by the time the Maria Kostarfin took over, over 60% of the district's teachers were 40 years and above, and therefore any layoffs could look like age discrimination. What's your response to that?
Well, when she came in, her goal, her speeches were to change the culture, you know. And it sounded good to me. I was excited about it, but I did not know it meant out with the old and in with the new. To me, that's what happened. And when I started dealing with it legally, I started seeing my coworkers. How did you get here? How did you get here? And we all had the same thing in common. My test scores outscored the state of Georgia. And you said I was insubordinate?
Well, in one case, they said you were insubordinate, I guess, because you wanted to go see a performance that your kids were giving?
Well, no, it was just a paper trail to get rid of me. I have never had an OR record. I have never...
What does OR stand for?
When teachers or parents complain against you. I've never had a record where a parent came to complain about me. I was never late. I did not take a whole lot of days off because I was concerned about my students missing their learning. So I didn't take a whole lot of days off. And then when I did take days off, it was like I committed a crime. So I noticed that the younger teachers were going to workshops, going a lot of different places, being involved, running things, so to speak, the after-school program. I asked to work at the after-school program. They told me they had enough, you know. But the whole after-school program were teachers younger than me, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and they can hire two new teachers for what
they
because
pay
because you had been in this system
yes.
for so long.
And then the benefits too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We're talking with Cheryl Patterson. She was a teacher with the Atlanta Public School District for 23 years, laid off in 2013. And also with us is GSU law professor Charlotte Alexander. Now, this case, Charlotte, got approval to become a class action case. What does that tell us? Does it give us any clue to what the court is thinking?
Well, so actually the ADEA treats group litigation a little differently from other types of law. And so this case was approved to be what's called a collective action, which means that notice goes out to a group of teachers who could potentially be affected by the allegations that the plaintiffs are making. So I think it was from spring of 15 to spring of 2016, essentially, it during that time period, teachers who were 40 and over who were working for the system got notice saying, hey, this lawsuit is proceeding. You can now opt in to join it. And so it's a preliminary ruling by the judge that says that there seems to be enough here that enough to allow notice to go out, but it's not a ruling on what we call the merits of the
right.
case, whether the plaintiffs are likely to win or to lose.
So let's say that I am my age, which is 47, so I'm protected against age discrimination, my advanced age. So how do I know if I'm laid off? How do I know if it's age discrimination or not? What are the signs?
Well, it's a really difficult question to answer in the abstract because so much in these cases turns on the individual circumstances. So who said what when, what the statistics look like. So like we were saying, if older workers seem to be laid off in disproportionate numbers, they seem to be overrepresented among the people laid off. So it's sort of it's a question where you're looking at sort of all of the evidence together. What sort of treatment are older workers receiving in the workplace as opposed to younger workers?
Well, excuse me. What was interesting to me when I first got to this particular school, I was only there for 2 years. One of the teachers I asked, she befriended me as a new teacher. I say, "Who's the oldest faculty member here?" She said, "You are." And it was no hesitation. It was no hesitation whatsoever. Now, the year before, a few older teachers had retired. But that lady was able to tell me that I was the oldest member on the faculty. And it was one more. It was one more that was my age. So, and the ones that they use. Now, you go there and you see a lot of older teachers, but those are retired teachers that have come back to substitute, that they have allowed to come back to substitute.
What do you want APS to do?
I want them, first of all, to think about our children. That's the first thing. Secondly, I want them to put themselves in my place. I've sacrificed my entire life for the benefit of our future. So I want them to put our children first and to treat teachers like they'd like to be treated. I didn't work my whole life to be called insubordinate, willful neglect of duty with test scores that are higher than the state of Georgia.
Charlotte, you were talking about how difficult it is to prove this. And in the 2 minutes that we have left, how does one, looking back at cases that have been successful, what were sort of the deciding factors that, I don't want to say smoking gun, but you know what I mean.
Right, right. And certainly if you have supervisors, managers who are out and out saying, we want new blood, we think we need a younger workforce. So those sorts of sort of open and obvious discriminatory statements make it a lot easier for the plaintiffs to win. But those don't always come up. And so what you tend to look at a lot of times is statistics. You look at the number of people who are being negatively affected by a certain move or a certain policy by the employer. And if those are overwhelming, then they can get you, again, part of the way there. But these are difficult cases to win.
Yeah.
And the way that the courts have interpreted this law over time have also made it more difficult for plaintiffs to win these cases without the sort of overwhelming what you call smoking gun type.
Yeah, like
of
an
evidence.
Email from the superintendent saying,
right.
Ha 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 ha,
right.
Which did not happen. In,
right.
In light of that, since I made a bad joke, let me again read a portion of the statement from the Atlanta Public School District. They say APS vehemently denies allegations of age discrimination, intends to vigorously defend against these claims. The case is in its early stages. This is still part of their statement. And APS looks forward to proving no such discrimination took place again. End quote. We have been speaking with Charlotte Alexander. She's a GSU law professor specializing in employment law. And Cheryl Patterson, who's a former teacher with the Atlanta Public School District. She's now part of a federal age discrimination lawsuit that, along with 100 former colleagues. And I want to say thank you so much, Charlotte and Cheryl.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
If you have comments on that or anything else, you know how to reach us. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Just ahead, a quest to name the children who once ran Georgia's cotton mills. First, though, solving an equation the way you solve a crime. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. University of Georgia professor Gregory Robinson was recently honored for his contributions to chemistry. Dr. Robinson specializes in combining unlikely elements, and he does this in his lab where he also tries to use plain language to talk about his research. This year, Dr. Robinson was named a fellow with London's Royal Society of Chemistry. And Gregory Robinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Many people don't know what the London Royal Society of Chemistry is. So what does this mean to you to become a part of that very old and august group?
Well, it's a great honor to begin with. It's the RSC, the Royal Society of Chemistry, is the largest scientific organization dedicated to chemistry in Europe, is the British equivalent of the American Chemical Society, but it's much older. And so it's just a great honor. Some of the most noted chemists in the world were previously fellows of the RSC. So it's humbling as well as a great honor.
And you now get to add a bunch of extra letters to the end of your name, right?
I do. You are allowed to use the FRSC designation behind your name now.
But because you are awarded this because of the work that you've been doing, and I mentioned that it's partly combining unlikely elements, but what does that mean?
Basically it means that there are a number of chemical compounds that are made, we chemists say synthesized, that were long expected to be synthesized. But then there's a whole nother group of very, at first principles, unlikely compounds to be prepared. And we've made a habit, as it turns out, of finding unusual methods to synthesize molecules that at first glance would seem unstable.
And give me an example of those molecules. I understand that you have been working a lot with, we know them by very common names, but like silicon dioxide, which is sand, and silicon monoxide, which is quartz. We know the regular names of them, but you've been working with those chemically. What are you working on?
Well, those are two very great examples. If you look at the periodic table, and, you know, that's arguably the greatest invention of mankind ever, is the periodic table. The vertical columns are called groups, and the first element in group 14 is carbon, and the element right beneath carbon is silicon. And if we take carbon as an example, which we often do, we chemists know a great deal about carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. Those are molecular species, single molecular units. But silicon monoxide and silicon dioxide, they are not molecular species. They are what we call network solids. For example, sand is basically silicon dioxide, but it's a network solid. And so there's no molecular chemistry of silicon dioxide. And what we did recently, we found what I like to call a backdoor method by which, for the first time, we were able to isolate a molecular species, a chemical compound that contained discrete moieties of a silicon oxide. And so it was a great breakthrough fundamentally. And silicon dioxide, for example, chemists have long thought that it was impossible to get a molecular species, but we were able to fortunately stabilize that molecule.
Now, what the things that you're saying right now, especially because most people have no idea what moiety means, brings us to another topic that you're passionate about, I'm told, which is translating science into language that people can understand. I understand that you don't think students of science are actually taught how to do that, but why is it important?
Wow. Well, it's simply incredibly important. I think there's enough blame to go around. I think we as scientists have not traditionally done a very good job of communicating what we do to the public. And even the definition of chemistry, I think is significant. And there are many definitions of chemistry, but the one I like is the one that Roald Hoffman, a Nobel laureate, uses. And Professor Hoffman defines chemistry as the art, craft, science, and business of matter and the changes that it undergoes. And that's simply a beautiful definition of chemistry, and I just love that, because chemistry is part art, and it is part craft, and certainly as a science, but also as a business. And all of this is the is how we deal with the matter in the universe. And so we could begin with that. And I think that it's very important for scientists to be able to appropriately discuss science in plain language, because our society is coming more and more technologically supported and inclined, and more and more scientific issues will be on the ballot, you know, at the in the election booth. And so we need to be able to have a citizenry that is scientifically literate.
UGA Professor of Chemistry Gregory Robinson, now a fellow with London's Royal Society of Chemistry. Gregory, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Early 20th century photographer Lewis Hine made his mark documenting working conditions all over the country, but also in mill towns like those in Georgia. His photos led to the reform of child labor laws. And a new museum exhibit at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College tells the story of one family that he photographed in Tifton, Georgia. Historian Joe Manning's on a quest to actually learn more about the stories behind those photos, and he joins us from his home in Massachusetts. Joe, good morning.
Good morning.
Many people know Lewis Hine only through that one iconic photograph of the 11 workers eating their lunch on the I-beam during construction of the Empire State Building. But he was a sociologist, and photography, the art of the photography, was always second to his social purpose. And you're a social worker as well. what is it that makes photographs particularly good for reform?
Well, you know, up to the point where the National Child Labor Committee, which is was the people that hired him to take the pictures, they never trying in vain really to change people's opinions of the value of child labor and whether it should be, you know, be banned or prohibited with laws. But you know, a lot of people in those days didn't live anywhere near mills, they wouldn't have witnessed, even if they lived near the mills, they wouldn't have witnessed children in there. A great deal of people did not have children working in mills, so they wouldn't have known it was going on. And by showing these incredible photographs that he took of these kids, many of them standing in front of a spinning machine or down in a coal mine or wherever they might be, it really didn't catch their conscience. And by displaying these pictures everywhere and having them in magazines and newspapers, and talking about it, people just look at it and say, "Well, gee, they could be my kids. I wouldn't want them to have that happen to my kids." And so then they, you know, they would write their congressman, or they would people, the congressman would see the pictures and say, "Well, you've got to do something about this. This is terrible." And so, without Hine's photographs, I think it would have been a long time after that before we would have had child labor laws.
Yeah, and it's kind of similar to what we see today, right, with the fact that people have become more mobilized around certain movements because we now have video, things that would have been just a printed report. Now there's video of it, which leads to widespread outrage.
Yeah, no question. You know, if Hine had lived in these times, you know, he probably would have... had a lot of his movies on YouTube,
yeah,
of kids in cotton mills and so on. It's no question that Hine set the stage for the use of photography to persuade social change.
But what happened with you, as I understand it, was you looked at these photos of these kids, and you're right, they're quite, in many cases, upsetting to see these.
Yes, or emotional.
Yeah, and you were captured. What do you remember? What it was that first photo that you saw?
Yeah, actually, I didn't go in it by. I actually went into it because somebody else asked me to do it. At the beginning, someone wrote a wonderful book. Elizabeth Winthrop wrote a wonderful book called Counting on Grace, which was inspired by a photo that Hine had taken, although it was had nothing to do with the actual child that was photographed, the girl. But she used the picture basically as a starting point to create a story about a child photographed by Lewis Hine. But she was a friend of mine, and she, when she finished the story, she said, "Now that I've finished the story, which is a novel, I'm sort of liberated to find out what really happened to her. And she says, I haven't got time. I'm already working on my next novel. And she said, show me the picture. And she said, do you think you could find out what happened to this girl? And my first reaction was, well, I don't know. I've never tried something like that before. And she said, well, why don't you really give it a try? And I said, okay. And in 2 weeks, I found one of her grandchildren. And, you know, and the grandchild didn't know anything about the photograph. It was just the family was just amazingly excited to know that this photograph existed of their, in this case, their grandmother. And once I did that story and interviewed descendants and told the story of this child's life, you know, Elizabeth said, why don't you go into the Library of Congress website and look at all the other Hine photos?
Yeah, you're blaming it on Elizabeth, but from what I've read in your interviews, you were hooked.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the experience, of course, the process of hunting down a family. I mean, you're doing genealogy sort of backwards. You're going from dead people to live people. And you know, the whole thrill of it and finding out who the child really was and what the child was like and so on. And to me, it was like, you know, I could do this the rest of my life. And you know, there's so many pictures, there's thousands of them. I would never do all the pictures. But I knew that not only would it be important information and also incredibly rewarding to do it, but I knew I was rewarding the families who had no idea these pictures existed.
So tell me another story, because it looks as though one of the things you questioned was how could Lewis Hine walk away from these children and never wonder what had happened to them? And you're now answering at least some of those questions. How many kids have you tracked down?
More than 350.
Holy cow!
That's what I say every morning. I know that's an 11-year period. And, you know, when you're really, really dedicated and you do it all the time and you get good at it, I'm good at it. I learned to be good at it. And, you know, you have, being a social worker, I connect with people well. So doing interviews with descendants, whether it's on the phone or in person, I know how to handle those interviews. I know what questions to ask and so on. So I know I have the power to look at a picture and say, 9 times out of 10, I'm probably going to be successful. And so every time I see a picture that really moves me, I just jump right into it.
So did you find any themes? I mean, there's all kinds of people who will tell you why it's so terrible for a kid's development to mm-hmm. be working at these very young ages and
sure.
in dangerous jobs. Did you find that reflected in these 350 stories that you tracked down?
It's hard to know. You know, having studied sociology, I know how important it is to look for trends when you gather information like this. And when you do that many stories that I've done, you can sort of think, well, you know, look at all of these stories and how do they have any common factors here. And I really haven't found that many common factors. The fact is that each one of them is in many ways a typical American story. You're not only having the story of that particular child, but you're having the story of how their descendants, the next several generations, made it in life. You know, did they go up the ladder in terms of economically? But maybe there's one kind of thing that I would say that is somewhat of a common thing is that most of these children they did not climb out of poverty. Particularly those in the South, which, of course, didn't catch up with the North in terms of industrialization until many, many years later. And so maybe that would be the case. But other than that, I mean, these kids surprise you. I mean, they survived, and many of them survived a long, long time, got married, had children, did the things that most people do. Maybe they struggled a lot, but we all struggle a little bit in our lives. And most of them wouldn't have become rich, that's for sure. But a lot of them are very smart, even though they weren't well-educated. I mean, there are many stories about kids that I've heard, you know, from children or grandchildren saying, well, my father didn't go to pass the fourth grade, but he helped me with my math homework.
Before we go, in the last 2 minutes that we have,
sure.
The one of the things that you have not tracked down is more child workers, I assume, because Lewis Hine's photographs helped to completely reform the state of child labor laws, not just in Georgia, but all over the country.
Yes.
So one change that you did find, I assume, is that their children and their grandchildren had a very different life.
Well, of course. And, you know, not only because the child labor laws began to prohibit it, but child labor actually became somewhat of an impractical thing to do because as technology improved after World War I, a lot of factories started using, you know, what might have been not called automation then, but they used heavier machines and more difficult machines. Children couldn't learn to do it, and so of course you know, children and families over the generations have benefited tremendously from the growth of things like the auto industry, the steel industry, and also from the Roosevelt era with all the government programs to lift people out of poverty and the GI Bill and all those other kinds of things. They've gone through American history over the last 100 years, and they've grown generally in their economic situations simply by modernization.
That is historian Joe Manning. His research on photographer Lewis Hine is part of a traveling museum exhibit. You can see it at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College and get more details at gpbnews.org. Joe, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Mine too. Thank you.
Just ahead, a college class goes down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories. It's the latest in our series, Lessons from Left Field. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tuesday is Election Day in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. Voters are heading to the polls to pick a replacement for Tom Price. Tomorrow, we will talk about what actually drives voter turnout. First, though, we want to hear from you. What issues matter to you most when you're voting for members of Congress, or do you actually stay home if it's not a presidential election? Call us at 404-500-9457 and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. Belief and fact do not always line up. An Emory University class dives into the convoluted world of conspiracy theories and how they actually influence American politics. This is a part of our occasional series, Lessons from Left Field, in which we look into unusual classes held around the state. So joining me now is Emory instructor Felix Harcourt. Hi there, Felix.
Hi.
Also here are two students, Laura Marquez. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
And Carolyn Conkey.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to have all of you here. Felix, what classifies as a conspiracy theory? How do you separate a conspiracy theory from an actual question that might be credible and put in the Washington Post?
It's an excellent question. It's one that we actually spend considerable time in the class discussing how to define what a conspiracy theory is and how to define who a conspiracy theorist is. And at its heart, a conspiracy theory is any conspiracy for which evidence cannot be shown. Where that then extends out to becomes, I think the word you used before was convoluted, and
yeah,
that's an excellent word to use with regard to these ideas.
Well, one person most Americans recognize as a conspiracy theorist is talk radio show host Alex Jones. He's read a number of conspiracy theories. For example, he believes 9/11 was an inside job orchestrated by the U.S. government.
When we question official stories where the system has the motive, the means, it basically stands to gain, that is patriotic thing to do. Because if you're not aware of false flags, self-inflicted wounds, staged terror attacks, then you invite the system to do this.
So, Felix, how do you then approach some of these ones that most people just sort of dismiss them out of hand? Alex Jones, for example, says he has evidence that 9/11 was an inside job. So you're raising your eyebrows, but that's what he says. So how do you approach that?
Really what the class is about is to be able to take these things, these ideas that it is easy to marginalize, it is easy to mock, because they are so far outside of our kind of understanding of the reality of the situation, and to consider them within their historical context, their social, their cultural context, to confront and dismantle them and to figure out where are these ideas coming from? Why are they being put forward? What situates them within our current society? And to what extent can we understand them as part of this long history of American conspiracism? And particularly to look at the kind of tropes and cliches that conspiracy theorists tend to use to try to put those ideas over. The idea that we tend to refer to in the class as the symbolism of evidentiary rigor, right? There's not actual evidence, but it seems as though there is evidence.
Before we get to our students here, let's actually hear some people that we spoke to on the streets of Atlanta. We asked them if there were any conspiracy theories that they believe in.
9/11, I do believe, was something they're trying to keep secret. They're not giving out the full story, which leaves a lot of people on the fence and skeptical about, was it real?
I definitely believe in Illuminati. I feel like it's something weird going on with all the powerful people.
I have concerns about whether or not the government controls the weather. The weather is like just so bipolar. One minute it's warm, one minute it's cold.
Okay. So, Laura, let's start with you. Did you believe any conspiracy? Do you believe in any conspiracy theories?
No. I came into the class feeling very skeptical of conspiracy theories. I think my instinct when hearing about them is just kind of thinking that they are, you know, people who believe in them are kind of nutty or, you know, just believing in falsehoods. Yeah, so I was definitely very skeptical.
Do you believe in any conspiracy theories?
I actually do. Going into the class, I was in very much the same place, thinking conspiracy theories are just things that crazy people say. I think what I've really learned is that, well, I don't necessarily agree with how far conspiracy theories tend to take it. A lot of times there's a little bit of an element of truth. You don't make a conspiracy about a thing where everyone knows all of the facts. So there's usually some element, not what the conspiracists say there is, but there's something with what the government did that triggered this idea of conspiracism in that context.
All right. I want to play a clip referring to one of the most persistent conspiracy theories ever. This is author David Talbot, who says he believes there were two shooters in JFK's assassination, one of them tied to the CIA.
No one else had the organizational power to do it and the kind of way of covering it up in the CIA.
And, of course, here's Oliver Stone. He's the filmmaker behind 1991's JFK. He also believes there were two shooters, and here he is speaking to CNN.
I resort always to the basics, like common sense, your own eyes. There is this wonderful document called the Zapruder film that shows you the time frame and shows you what the shots were doing step by step. And we estimate the people in the community, five shots, maybe six. And you show in the kill shot, Kennedy is going back and to the left very clearly. The shot has to come from the front.
So, Felix, I have to imagine you have to spend some time on the JFK assassination, right?
Certainly.
When you come from Oliver Stone, who made a whole movie claiming that they have evidence, then how do you teach your students to sort of sift through what you've already said sounds authentic and credible?
It's a question of putting something like Oliver Stone, putting somebody like Oliver Stone within their historical context and seeing where his ideas come from. And we can track the ideas that Oliver Stone puts forward back to really the immediate aftermath of the assassination. And you start to see the contemporary New Left concerns about government power, about LBJ, about the rising national security state and the war in Vietnam really give birth to consistent conspiracist tropes. And understanding it in that way allows us to kind of dismantle current conspiracist thinking within this broader context.
Laura, were there conspiracy theories that you ended up taking more seriously that you now think differently of? And is one of them the JFK assassination?
Yeah, I think the JFK assassination was very interesting because I don't think I could have imagined how many theories there actually were. And we didn't even cover all of them, but we had a one or two page sheet with just a laundry list of theories, and I couldn't have imagined. So it definitely put some doubt into what I had previously believed, poked some holes into the kind of narrative that has been accepted as the official narrative.
Carolyn, are you ready to reveal which conspiracy theory you've had second thoughts about?
So I actually had the same experience as Oliver Stone. We watched the Zapruder film in class, and seeing that, reading how people had analyzed, I was like, this doesn't quite add up. And obviously, I'm not a forensic scientist, so I can't actually verify that what they are saying is how it's supposed to go is actually how it's supposed to go, but just reading the story doesn't quite make sense to me. So it opened up to me the possibility of not necessarily one of the more out there, like there's two Lee Harvey Oswald kind of conspiracies, but the idea that what the government has told us about the Kennedy assassination isn't quite what actually happened.
So you're not all the way to Oliver Stone?
Not quite, but on the same path.
Ready. Okay. Let's hear from journalist David Aronovich. One of his missions is to debunk conspiracy theories. He wrote a book called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Here he is speaking to NPR in 2010.
The thing about dealing with conspiracy theories is you can't just assume right from the beginning that any conspiracy theory is automatically wrong because it seems to violate common sense. I mean, you're absolutely right. You have to go back to first principles and say, what is the evidence for this?
So, but one of the claims that he makes is that conspiracy theories, even when they're completely outlandish, actually have a huge impact on culture. And that sounds like something that you say in your class as well. How does that add up? For example, the conspiracy theories that we didn't land on the moon. How do things like that actually shape politics and culture?
It's a good question. In large part, especially as we move through the kind of the later 20th century and especially post-Watergate, what conspiracy theories really do is help fuel growing distrust of the government as a body. And you see this almost feedback loop created where real conspiracies are revealed, right? The CIA did engage in something like MKUltra. Nixon was behind the break-in at the Watergate Hotel.
There actually was a Soviet spy in Congress during the whole Red Scare, for example. That turned out to be true.
And as these ideas come out, as they're released, they give greater fuel to the idea that there are even bigger secrets hiding. And so you see this growing snowball of distrust. And that distrust gets almost weaponized politically. It's a very, very useful tool to galvanize voters.
So then let's hear about a very recent conspiracy theory. This is President Trump tweeted that he'd been wiretapped by former President Obama. Federal investigators, I want to emphasize, no one has found any evidence of this at all. But Trump revealed that he got this from a Fox News pundit.
We said nothing. All we did was quote a certain very talented legal mind who was the one responsible for saying that on television. I didn't make an opinion on it. That was a statement made by a very talented lawyer on Fox. And so you shouldn't be talking to me. You should be talking to Fox.
So, Laura, what do you take away from this? Learning more about conspiracies, has it changed the way you consume news headlines?
Yeah, and I think especially in today's era, we're nearing this phase where we're not really agreeing on anything. So people have two different sets of the truth, and neither one accepts the others. And that is something very prevalent in conspiracy theory. So I think it's definitely, I'm seeing it more and more, and conspiracy theories being propagated. It's definitely more prevalent in my life.
We have a tweet from Melanie Harper who says, I can believe in business conspiracies like nicotine spiking easier than government conspiracies. Greed is a permanent motive. Let's hear about another relatively recent conspiracy theory, again involving Donald Trump. He joined the birther movement, which he questioned whether President Obama was born in the U.S. He told NBC News in 2011 that he just wanted to see the birth certificate.
If he doesn't, it's one of the greatest scams in the history of politics and in the history, period. Yeah. You are not allowed to be a president if you're not born in this country. He may not have been born in this country. And I'll tell you what, 3 weeks ago, I thought he was born in this country. Right now, I have some real doubts.
There's no doubt. Again, let me just emphasize that is not true. President Obama was born in the United States. But Carolyn, if you give more credibility to some conspiracy theories than you did to others, how do you go about doing that? If you see a news headline come up, what process do you go through to judge its truthiness?
I think a lot of it goes back to just evaluating the evidence kind of for yourself. I think, especially if we're looking at how President Trump tweets out some of these conspiracies, he just asserts it without any of the evidence actually being there. And it's really hard to evaluate whether or not there's any truthiness to that statement without looking at the evidence yourself. And I think that was a lot of what kind of changed my beliefs in this class, was looking not just at what the conspiracist said, but what actually happened and the facts that were behind that. And I think when you look into what they claim supports your evidence, you can really see whether or not they're making some kind of crazy leap or there is some kernel of truth that you can keep investigating more.
Okay, in light of that, you guys all had to create your own conspiracy theory, right?
Yes.
So, Carolyn, what was yours?
So my conspiracy theory is that following the Kennedy assassination, Jackie Kennedy continued to push for water fluoridation, which there's a whole conspiracy
that
helps control our minds, to make the country believe in Camelot so that Kennedy could die a martyr without any of the complications of his presidency and his policies coming out.
Wow, that is a very sophisticated conspiracy theory. Laura, what was yours?
Mine's not as sophisticated. Mine was that Jimmy Carter's peanut farm was actually a money laundering front for the Georgia Mafia, and that kind of helped him elevate to power and get to the White House.
That would be an interesting movie.
Yeah.
Felix, why do you have them create their own conspiracy theories?
I think it's the best concrete example of the way in which these theories get created, and to have to do so yourself is a really good inoculation, to use a word that anti-vaccination conspiracy theorists might not be a fan of, but it's a good inoculation against this kind of pseudo-historical thinking that fuels an awful lot of conspiracy theory.
Like the Illuminati. You're trying to prevent your students from being fooled.
Yes, exactly.
So, Laura, what makes a good conspiracy theory? What makes one successful and another not?
I think primarily it has to be convincing. And a lot of what we've seen over the course of the semester is that conspiracists include a wide variety of sources and cite all these links. And our professor has definitely made sure to emphasize that we should have footnotes because in crafting these papers, it makes it look more scholarly and like there's a whole bunch of evidence that you're presenting to your audience and your readers.
Carolyn, did you want to add into that what you think makes one conspiracy theory successful?
I think, another part of it has to do with kind of the political movement that's behind it. Some of the most successful conspiracy theories we've been learning about were kind of taken over by some kind of political movement and moved into the mainstream. And I think when there's that kind of partisan belief pushing behind it, that helps make it a lot more convincing because people have a reason to believe in it. It's not just random distrust of the government. It's distrust of the government to get my policy agenda pushed forward.
So, Felix, most of the people listening are never going to take your class. But what advice would you give people sifting through their Twitter and Facebook feed on how to inoculate themselves against conspiracy theories?
I think Laura made a good point in bringing up footnotes. Right? Conspiracy theorists love footnotes. They love the symbolism of evidence. And I would say always click through the evidence to see what it is that they're actually citing in support of their ideas, to see whether or not it does in fact support that case.
Right, like the long debunked study that supports the anti-vaccine movement, which has been debunked over and over and over again. They may be citing that.
Right.
That is Emory University instructor Felix Harcourt. We also spoke with two of his students, Laura Marquez and Carolyn Conkey. We're talking about a class Felix teaches, which is about conspiracy theories. This conversation is part of our series, Lessons from Left Field. And I want to say thank you to Felix and Laura and Carolyn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we always love to get your comments. If you have a conspiracy theory you want to float by us, we want to hear it. You can email us the details on secondthought@gpb.org. Just call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.